Let's sort of start with some introductions, sort of introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, maybe sort of your expertise as well, and just sort of go around the table slash up to Fort Collins. So why don't we begin with you, Nolan?
Sure. Well, I'm Nolan Duskin. I'm the state climatologist for Colorado here at Colorado State University, work at the Colorado Climate Center, and monitor the climate of the state by gathering data from a variety of sources, putting it in historical perspective, and trying to tell the story from that.
Fantastic. Jennifer?
I'm Jennifer Stark. I'm the meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service office in Pueblo. And primarily, I've worked for the National Weather Service now for almost 20 years. And in Pueblo, we focus mainly on the southeast corner of the state. And we do aviation forecasting, severe weather warnings and forecasts, winter weather forecasts and warnings, and fire weather, as well as gathering climate information and maintaining equipment.
Matthew?
And I'm Matthew Kruger. I am a broadcast meteorologist with the Fox affiliate here in Colorado Springs. My job is to interpret the very scientific data that comes in from the weather and give a good, accurate forecast to southeastern Colorado, a very similar coverage area than what the National Weather Service in Pueblo has.
Great. So let's sort of start with kind of the difference between weather and climate. They are two different things. So let's sort of define, as it pertains to what you do, how you look at those topics. And whoever would like to start, please feel free.
I'll start.
Thank you, Nolan.
There's lots of, analogies that you can use. And one of them would be that weather is the clothes you choose to wear today, and climate is the wardrobe that you have in your closet. What you need to cover the whole spectrum of what weather can dish out through the seasons and over the years. So the weather is the now and what's coming up, and the climate is the whole range of possibilities that we've seen for many years of past experience.
Jennifer?
I would say for us, we really focus in on the first 7 days of the forecast, but there are different parts of NOAA and the National Weather Service that do some climate prediction, looking out a month in advance, up to 14 months in advance, and give people kind of an outlook of what to expect. But primarily in the National Weather Service Forecast Office, we are looking at from the starting point, the minute we walk in the door, giving a very detailed forecast for the first 24 hours and additional information out for the next several days.
Matthew?
I'll say as a broadcaster, climate doesn't matter as much, you know, getting that information out to the public. It's really the weather that's happening right now. Climate becomes useful when you compare whatever the weather is to whatever our climatological weather is, whether that be snow, rain, or cold, warm for that particular day. But my job is to really just forecast the weather. Climate can sometimes maybe act as a roadmap, although that may be a little bit misleading to even say that much too.
So how much, what kind of tools and science do you use to go to forecast the weather, and what sort of overlap is there between Nolan, what you do as a climatologist versus, say, you know, weather forecasters?
Well, I'm definitely keeping track of what's happening and what has happened, putting the current into historic perspective, where the rest of the folks at the table today are really focused on what's coming up next and getting that word out to people. So I'm more definitely the weather historian of the group.
So does that mean you just, you know, look at books? I mean, what kind of science do you use?
Definitely the science of understanding the climate system, knowing what are the factors that affect our climate, which is very much our latitude, our elevation, the location of the mountains, and our proximity to the things like the Pacific Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico, which control where our moisture sources come from. And those factors put together with the rotation of the Earth and around the the sun and the tilt of the axis that creates the seasons. And lo and behold, those are the basic ingredients of the climate. That's the fundamentals of the science that I work with. And then it's the raw data that we collect from many weather stations around the state and around the country and really around the world that allows us the raw ingredients of describing that climate.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer?
I would say from the National Weather Service perspective, our team of meteorologists in the office definitely have all the fundamental education and science background in meteorology and all the many other science aspects that come into play there, physics, a lot of physics, dynamic meteorology, oceanography, many, many different elements of physical sciences come into play. But then throughout our careers, we also learn about radar meteorology, satellite meteorology, and obviously here in Colorado, a big, big factor for us is understanding the topography and the terrain and what influences that has on our local weather, and also the limitations of forecast models, computer models, what they can do, what they can't do, and some of the things that the human element has to interpret for human forecasting, you know. So what is really going to affect the people that live here?
Mm-hmm. Matthew?
And I'm going to echo what Jennifer says. The National Weather Service has a little bit more access to some of the computer models out there, and there's numerous computer models that we can use that have different runs that they do per day. We have a little bit more limited access to those. But we use that to put together a forecast, and then like she said, there's limitations to those computer models themselves. It really takes a whole lot of experience to understand the terrain around here, especially in southern Colorado, which has an extremely complex and diverse terrain setup. From Monument Hill down to Pueblo, then back up towards the Raton Mesa Eastern Plains, you've got 14, just in El Paso County alone, you have a 14,000 foot mountain, and it goes down to almost 5,000 feet on the eastern side of the county. So it definitely does take some human interpretation in that. But then the computer models kind of serve as a good roadmap too.
You're talking a lot about the terrain, and I do obviously want to talk about the terrain. Mm-hmm. But I want to sort of set it up in terms of what's the general weather and climate for southern Colorado here?
Wow, that's a broad question.
Jennifer.
Because, I mean, I've worked here in this office now for about 3 years, and we have a little bit of everything. We have winter weather. We have severe convective weather.
What does that mean?
Convective weather is thunderstorms. So, and severe, we define that as thunderstorms that have 1-inch diameter hail or larger, and or produce wind gusts of 60 miles per hour or greater. Or it can be a tornado producing thunderstorm. That could be severe thunderstorm as well. So, we just run the gamut here in southern Colorado. We can have a mix of all three types of weather on any given day. We can have the mountain areas of our forecast area having a winter weather event, the plains maybe having a fire weather threat, and then some areas of the plains perhaps having severe thunderstorms. So it's a very, very complex setup for forecasters to deal with, and oftentimes you get anything and everything on any given day. So it's a great place to live and work and be interested in meteorology.
Mm-hmm. Matthew?
You know, to echo again what Jennifer said, in April of 2007, I was working and doing some reports about weather around southern Colorado, and one of the most exciting things of my meteorology career, we had blizzard warnings for portions of the Front Range in Colorado, and then we also had a tornado warning pop up on the far eastern plains at the exact same time. And so that's unusual to see something like that. And there are very few places in this world that you're going to see in such a short distance a blizzard warning at the same time as a tornado warning. It's extremely diverse down here. We have our banana belts, which we often talk about, one of those being the Upper Arkansas Valley around Salida, Buena Vista, which because of their location, their climatology is going to be just a little bit different. You know, they're going to average less snow and warmer temperatures during the winter than places just barely outside, a few miles outside these towns, even around Canyon City. You know, that's a more difficult place to forecast for me, simply because it's a little bit closer to the mountains, but it kind of sits in an area where it's shadowed a little bit, in some cases with snow. Then you've got the Eastern Plains, which are going to be extremely diverse too. So to pinpoint and to make a blanket statement about what the weather or climate is for Southern Colorado, in one word, diverse. You know, unfortunately, I don't know if we could put an exact number on that.
Mm-hmm. Nolan, what goes into making it such a diverse area of climate in Southern Colorado?
Consider the distance that Southern Colorado is from the Pacific Ocean. That's the primary source of winter moisture. And there's a whole lot of mountain ranges upstream and often a storm track that is not favorable for bringing Pacific storms to Southeast Colorado. But when things are just right, the Gulf of Mexico is still a long way away, but it's closer to Southeast Colorado than any other part of Colorado. So when conditions are right, the slow-moving storm spinning across New Mexico, pulling the moisture up across Texas and Oklahoma, packing it up against the southern front range, voila, the ingredient for very big storms, some of the time, dry most of the time. And of course, so it's those very factors, the high elevation, the complex terrain, and the distance from the moisture sources of the Pacific and the Gulf, that you throw them all together and you've got a fascinating part of the state. The Southeast Colorado and the San Luis Valley are known for sunshine. The area is loved for sunshine, but you also know that sunshine gets a little irritating after a while when there's too much of it, like last year when you couldn't buy moisture for much of the year.
Does that make you're talking about how Southeastern Colorado is sort of the unique area of the state? Well, what about as far as in relation to the country? I mean, are there parts of New Mexico or Wyoming that are similar in sort of the climate because of the topography and the terrain of the areas? Or is Southeastern Colorado really one of the most unique places in the country when it comes to climate and weather?
There aren't many places. There are no places like El Paso County, for example, with an isolated, very high peak sticking out into otherwise plains near the Arkansas Valley, the pipeline for low-level moisture. So it is unique. At the same time, there are features of the climate of northern New Mexico that are very similar to southern Colorado, which is why you see some of the same biological plant communities and the pinyon juniper environments, et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let us expand a little bit more on this terrain. With the mountains, you've got the plains, you've got the foothills would fall somewhere in between the mountains and the plains. Talk a little bit about how those sort of affect the weather and the climate of the region. Jennifer?
Okay. I'll attempt to put together a summary, but I would say that for forecasters dealing with the mountains and analyzing storms that come over the mountains, there's always the concern of how much moisture is going to accompany a storm system, how much of that moisture is going to be wrung out as it crosses the mountain ranges, and how much is going to be left once it comes across the plains. Another issue with the rapid changes in elevation, like Matthew was saying about El Paso County, you have the Palmer Divide on the north side of El Paso County, you have the Rampart Range and Pikes Peak to the west. Then on the east side of El Paso County, the terrain is much lower, and then as you travel further south in El Paso County, you're going downhill as you go into the Arkansas River Valley. So all of those things have an important role to play as we have a storm system in the area. What prevailing wind direction is going to impact the area? If it's coming from a northerly direction, we know the Palmer Divide's probably going to get some precipitation, maybe some snowfall if it's wintertime. If it's an easterly direction, then we might see a little more snowfall across El Paso County. If it's a northerly wind, the southern part of the county is not going to get anything. If it's a northwest wind, you might see something in the mountains and nothing on the plains. So it's just extremely, extremely difficult to forecast for, and it just has everything to do with the sensible weather that we see when there's a storm system coming into play. In addition to that, the numerical and computer models just do not handle that terrain and that change in terrain very well, because their resolution, the scale that they're at, just cannot resolve those changes in elevation in that area. So it's a very, very important factor in our jobs, but also I think it's one of the elements that keeps meteorology interesting, but also it's a very humbling job because sometimes we're not right.
It's a wonder any of us still have hair, I think, sometimes. Yeah, you know, mountains can act as a shield. Moisture coming in directly from the west. We all know west winds all over the Front Range of Colorado are downslope winds, and that means that moisture has a real tough time making it over those mountains. And if we have strong enough westerly winds, it actually dries us out. We can have the moisture stuck in the foothills, or especially around the Continental Divide. On the flip side of that, an easterly wind is the exact opposite. Particularly for El Paso County, a southeast wind typically brings us a little bit more moisture for the opposite reason. All that moisture, low-level moisture, comes up against the mountains, can't quite make it over the mountains, so it just kind of pools in along the Front Range. That could produce anything from low clouds, fog, to snow. That's some of our biggest snowfalls have come from easterly winds. What's sometimes frustrating and sometimes it's very difficult to forecast exactly where that wind direction is going to come from. Mm-hmm. Any slight change in that wind direction can throw off the forecast quite a bit, especially in the wintertime with snowfall. And if it's a southerly wind versus a southwesterly wind, that's going to have a huge impact mm-hmm. on what the snow we see.
Nolan, do you have anything that you would like to add?
Well, we're thinking, because it's still winter, we're thinking in winter mode, but the game changes as you get into summer. And every day, the ingredient for storms is present in that there's the mountain areas, the high elevations heat up fast, convective updrafts form early. And the ingredient that is the most key ingredient to whether something happens or not ends up being whether we have moisture available. And again, most of the time, southeast Colorado, northern New Mexico is dry. Occasionally, that's not the case. And often beginning around the first, second, third week of July, something happens, low-level moisture increases, and daily thunderstorm activity develops. And we don't see the same patterns in northern Colorado and Wyoming as you do down there. The wet mountains are very wet come July and August, even though they struggle for moisture at other times of year. Watching these summer convective patterns where the storms are very isolated, but yet where they begin to form is totally affected by that topography. What I pay particular attention to in southeast Colorado, northern New Mexico, is the infrequent but nevertheless always present opportunity for extreme rains. You got a taste of that in the Colorado Springs area the middle of last September. But from really May through even late April, through early October, the potential is there, but it's strongest in July, August, and September for these incredibly intense localized storms. There are historic records of up to a foot or more of rain in less than a day. And with the terrain that you have there, the consequences can be grave. Last year, Jennifer, you'll have to remind me the exact numbers. It was 4 to 6 inch rains in a short amount of time in mid-September and very significant flooding that resulted. But it can be way worse than that. That's one of the things I really think of when I think of southern Colorado.
Right. I think just following up on that, you're right. We are still kind of in winter mindset, but here before too long, we're going to be talking more and more about thunderstorms and preparing for severe weather season. And what I like to tell people is that we need three basic ingredients for thunderstorms to form, and that is a source of lift, so lifting that air, a source of moisture, and instability in the atmosphere, meaning that if the air is lifted, it wants to continue rising. So just having that mountains there, that topography, you already have a source of lift to get thunderstorms beginning. And sometimes we can just have meager amounts of moisture in the atmosphere and still have thunderstorms develop. They may not produce a lot of rainfall. And in those cases, they may produce lightning. And without that wetting rainfall, then we have some fire weather concerns or fire concerns as they maybe ignite fires on the plains or even in the mountains. So it's always an interesting setup here during the summer season, and certainly flash flooding thunderstorm producers are a big threat and a big concern, because also with our interesting topography, when we have that heavy rainfall, it's going to run downhill, it's going to fill up the creeks and streams very, very rapidly. We have dry creek beds that can overflow, that can run across roads, and it just can be a very, very dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking, Matthew, you mentioned a tornado earlier, tornadoes on the eastern and the eastern plains, I think it was. What I'm curious about is if we have all these conditions that make it right for an occasional blizzard, for example, or occasional monsoon-type rains or hail, why do we not see more tornadoes, specifically closer to the mountains?
Well, I would say that as you go further out on the southeast plains, certainly you have a higher likelihood and a higher frequency of tornadoes, but it certainly is possible. We've had them in El Paso County before. We've had them in Pueblo County before. The frequency may not be as high as some other parts of the country or even as you go further out on the plains, but it's certainly there. And I don't want anyone to believe in a myth that the mountains are going to protect us from having a tornado or a significant tornado move through the area, Colorado Springs, Pueblo, anywhere along the Front Range, because it can and it does happen.
Mm-hmm. Matthew?
The best focal point for tornadoes for Colorado, if there's a certain feature that would focus a lot of these, would be the dry line. And the dry line typically sets up east and well east of the I-25 corridor and the foothills. Your stronger tornadoes, the more photogenic tornadoes that we often see pictures of. It is extremely possible, though, to have tornadoes not only on the immediate and adjacent foothills, but also in the mountains. Since I've been here, we've had tornadoes in Woodland Park. We had a tornado in the South Park near Hartzell and the reservoirs there. Just last year, we had a weak tornado in Fountain. And, of course, we all know about the Ellicott tornado. Just to the east of Colorado Springs. They can happen. Your stronger tornadoes typically tend to be focused along the dry line. That usually doesn't get set up until you get several miles, in some cases hundreds of miles, east of I-25 at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking a little bit about flooding sort of as a significant issue, specifically with the rains that happened last year in September, that when those rains do come, the dry ground can't absorb it, and so therefore we have flooding. I'm assuming I might be putting words into your mouth.
I think that's a big aspect to our very sandy soil. Mm-hmm. It definitely does not absorb the water. Plus, when we get these heavy rainfall events, it's coming down very quickly. So it's almost too much for many soils to absorb, and it results in a lot of runoff. And then also in the urban areas where we have a lot of pavement, then we're going to have more runoff.
Mm-hmm. With that flooding, sort of the flip side is the fact that we've sort of been dealing with drought a lot lately. In the past few years, there's been drought conditions, if I remember my statistics correctly. Why? Talk a little bit about sort of the drought that's happening in southern Colorado here.
I think that's a good question for Nolan.
Nolan?
Well, first of all, drought happens. You look at the historic records, and we have data from southeast Colorado that date back to the 1870s. And drought, defined as well below average precipitation for anything from a few months to even a few years happens on a not a predictable cycle, but on a very regular basis, so that rarely do you go more than 20 or 30 years without a really major multi-year drought. The drought that we experienced last year, 2011, was a part of this incredible, intense drought from northern Mexico all the way across New Mexico, eastern Arizona, and practically the entire state of Texas. And while it dropped off abruptly as you got north, you had to get north of the Arkansas Valley before you got to that transition line to more normal climate conditions. There's a lot of concern that this drought is not over yet and could continue for more than another year or at least another year. But that's, we don't have much skill in making long-range predictions like that. But the one thing we know is we rely on the precipitation that falls from the sky, and that precipitation is extremely variable. The difference between a very wet year and a very dry year will be perhaps a factor of four. A kind of a rule of thumb for the Great Plains is that your wettest year could easily be double your average, and your driest year will be less than half of your average. And yet we as human beings want the same amount of moisture each year. We want the rivers and our water supply to be consistent. We want our crops to be consistent. But nature doesn't work that way. So drought is a part of this cycle.
Well, if it's a part of a cycle, as you're saying, then how does this current cycle that people are suggesting that 2011 is a part of this cycle compare to previous significant drought events in the area?
The drought of 2011, possibly continuing, although not as severe right now, is surprisingly, as severe as it seems, is still fairly easygoing compared to the drought just a few years ago in 2002, one of Colorado's driest years in recorded history. And this drought period, as significant as it seems, is relatively short compared to the droughts of the observed past, of the 1950s, which lasted about 5 years, of the 1930s, which lasted nearly a decade with a couple of sharp interruptions and to squeeze in some major floods as well. So again, it seems cyclical, it comes and goes, but yet it's not a predictable cycle, so I cannot tell you what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm. Nolan, or I mean, Matthew or Jennifer?
It can be localized too. And some of the factors that we look at may even be a little misleading in some ways. For example, last September, you know, El Paso County at the official recording location, which is the airport in Colorado Springs, picked up what, 4.5 inches of rain, I believe, something like that.
It was over five.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So obviously for the yearly total, since that's the official climate location, it's gonna look a little bit better. It's gonna make the year's rainfall record look a lot better, because that accounts for about a quarter of our normal climatological precipitation for the year. Other sides of the city that didn't see that convective precipitation are going to still be in a pretty powerful drought. Keep in mind, of that 5 inches that fell too, a lot of that just ran off, and so we didn't see the benefits from it had that moisture been spread out over a couple weeks per se. So even though last year didn't end up as bad in Colorado Springs on paper, except for, you know, those couple days in September, it was still a pretty dry year. Pueblo, of course, didn't see that. And so the drought persisted there quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer?
One of the alarming things about last year was, as in our office, as we're doing forecasting and looking at the upcoming weather, we always expect some fairly strong storms in the late winter and spring months. So late February, March, even into the first part of April, we're expecting to see some winter snowstorms bring some beneficial snow and very moisture-laden snow to the plains, and we did not see that last year. And I think that was particularly alarming, and that's when we really identify, you know, this is a very dry situation. We're going into the warm, dry summer without the benefit of having that spring snowstorms or that spring moisture that we normally expect. So it will be very telling to see what happens the end of February, March, and April.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are critical months. I don't even want to talk about last spring. It was just windy and dry, and yeah, it was a rough spring, especially on the plains. You know, they depend on that spring moisture, which didn't get that.
We issued last year probably more red flag warnings. So that's a particular warning where we're telling people that fire weather conditions are going to be ripe for the development of and growth of out-of-control fires. If a fire were to start, it's going to spread, it's going to grow very quickly, it's going to be difficult for firefighters to fight. And we issued many of those last spring when normally we would be expecting to see some snow and maybe even some thunderstorms.
Nolan, is that typical in sort of this cyclical drought condition weather type of situation that you're talking about?
Problem is that it's easy to say cyclical and it's easy to say typical, and yet every year unfolds in a different way. Drought is really annoying, and I think you got a sense of that last year. The persisting dry winds. There weren't as many fires as they could have been. There could have been terrible fires last year. There were bad ones, but it could have been much worse. The general conditions out in the tropical Pacific, what we refer to as the El Nino Southern Oscillation, has been in the cool phase, what we call the La Nina phase, which historically correlates to higher probabilities of dryness and warmness across the southern states during the winter and spring. And wetter to the north, and that was certainly the case last year. But this year, the La Nina conditions were largely the same, not quite as well defined, and yet the weather patterns have been much different, just showing that it's a lot more complicated than we'd like to think.
Is Colorado sort of the epitome of forecasting here, that you know you've made it when you've gotten to Colorado?
I think for forecasters in the National Weather Service, they really have to be here for many, many years really to get a good handle on storm systems and how it's going to interact with the terrain and the topography and that pattern recognition that becomes so important. So I think the forecasters that work here, stay here, and really learn and absorb what Colorado weather is all about. It becomes a very passionate experience for them, but it's similar in other parts of the country. I worked in eastern Kansas, and working the severe weather events, the forecasters there are very passionate about that too. So I think if you love weather, you love forecasting weather, you find something interesting no matter where you are.
Mm-hmm. Matthew?
It's fascinating. My first job, which was back in the early 2000s, was in Wichita Falls, Texas. A good measure, a parameter for low-level moisture is the dew point. And they would often talk about dew points leading to summertime thunderstorms. There, a favorable dew point would be about 70 degrees for a thunderstorm. Here, we're never going to see a 70-degree dew point in Colorado Springs. For us, a 50-degree dew point, which is much lower, is very conducive to thunderstorms. You get out to the east, well east of here, and it's a very opposite. So it does take a little bit of experience to realize what makes weather work around here. That's certainly going to play a big role into forecasting for Southern Colorado.
You know, one of the adages you hear about the weather is if you don't like the weather, stick around. And I have heard that in multiple locations that I personally have lived, but it seems particularly relevant here. Is that anecdotal, or is there actually really evidence to support that?
There's evidence when you go up and down the east slope of the Rockies from Edmonton, Alberta, right down to Las Vegas, New Mexico, the most rapid changes, hour-to-hour changes in weather conditions, tend to occur in the lee of the Rockies. So weather forecasters in this area, and I got the hats are off to you. You guys do a great job, all things considered. But the changeability is greater here. There is change, and in all parts of the country, in all parts of the world. But yet there's documented evidence that the hour-to-hour weather changes can be greatest here on the lee side of the Rockies.
Well, I think it's particularly telling when we have a really cold morning in the spring or the summer, or what we would think of as cool, and we warm up 50 or 60 degrees throughout the day, or even, you know, we have these huge diurnal temperature swings. So that's just another interesting part of the forecasting here and some of the weather that we experience. You could be wearing a jacket in the morning, and then by mid-afternoon you're wearing short sleeves and shorts.
I mean, is that part of the, you know, the altitude that we're at? Does that play a role into that?
Oh, definitely in our dry climate. We're kind of a high desert climate.
Yeah, we're actually considered the arid plains, which sometimes we forget about. When we do have bouts of moisture, we are considered very arid here. And so the less moisture you have, the more ability you have for these huge temperature swings from nighttime to daytime. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, your coastal areas will not see a huge swing in temperature typically, like you would here, which would be very normal if our humidity is low enough.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the sort of the last spring was windy and dry. Oh. So tell me a little bit about why it's so windy every single spring. The wind here, and I don't know if Colorado Springs is unique or if Pueblo experiences the same, and sort of why is that? Why does that happen?
Well, there's a lot of factors. I think in the springtime, you know, it all comes back to the basic, you know, the earth and the winds are trying to balance out the temperature differences across the globe and across the continent. And so during the spring months and then again in the fall, and as you go into winter, you're going to have much more wind. You're going to have stronger storm systems, things like that. So it's just a function of the change of seasons, the jet stream location moving across the state. It's hard to put it kind of in a nutshell, but really during the spring months, we can have a lot of wind in southern Colorado, certainly Colorado Springs, Pueblo. Pueblo can be very, very windy. It's just an interesting environment.
I think that's probably one of the most, things that we can forecast around here, definitely, is the wind. We can definitely tell if it's going to be windy. Jennifer's right, has a lot to do with the jet stream. And the southern jet stream tends to be a little bit more active during the springtime, from what I've noticed, and that's going to help bring a lot of those upper-level winds. Because we sit so high at elevation, it's going to bring it a little bit closer to the surface. And a lot of your areas, some areas along the foothills are favored for some of those winds funneling through canyons. I know in the entire state, Boulder's known for getting some pretty strong winds. Certainly Pueblo, actually, can get some strong winds. The Air Force Academy here in El Paso County can see some pretty strong winds, but pretty much anywhere east of the foothills mm-hmm. can see some extremely strong winds. And being from the west in the springtime, a lot of times those are downslope winds, so they're carrying some very, very dry air.
Nolan?
One of the special things about spring and why you do associate wind with spring is the jet stream is still pretty strong, very active. As Jennifer pointed out, trying to balance the sharp temperature gradients as it's still cold to the north, but the areas to our south are warming up quickly as the sun comes overhead. And a big factor is the fact that the earth is heating up from the ground up. The upper level are still cold. The ground level is warming up quickly as we move through the spring months. And that means a more unstable environment where you get more mixing during the day. So those upper level winds that were howling all winter but weren't mixing down to the ground, now once it's spring and daytime conditions during the spring, you mix those upper level winds down much more quickly to the ground level. A little bit technical perhaps, but that's one of the big ingredients for why spring is so windy around here and over much of the high plains.
It's a wonder why kite shops aren't more popular around here. Nolan, you mentioned earlier that we were sort of in a La Nina pattern. Was that correct?
Correct.
How, you know, obviously you said that it's difficult for what you do to sort of make predictions, but how predictable is it to be in sort of a La Nina pattern or where El Nino is at any given season?
And this is a large scale phenomena that satellites have really helped us to do a better job of tracking and instrumenting the oceans with buoys, with instruments to measure sea surface temperature and near surface winds. And this El Nino Southern Oscillation is a marvelous phenomena balancing wind and ocean currents. And it does affect climate over large areas of the globe, but it doesn't control it. It affects it, it influences it to some degree, it moves the storm tracks around, but it doesn't drive every storm in a particular way. When we see a developing La Nina with the cool sea surface temperatures over the tropical Pacific off the coast of South America, we start thinking, the odds are tilting in favor of dryness for the Southern Rockies, for the Southeast Plains. But that doesn't mean it always works out that way. And part of the reason is it only takes a few storms, three or four storms, whether you get them or not, is going to be the difference between whether Southern Colorado has a wet year or a dry year. And you can get three or four big storms snuck in even when you're in an otherwise dry weather pattern. So that's one of the things that makes it tricky. The overall forecast of La Nina was darn good last year and has been useful this year, but the outcomes have been quite different because of the impact of a couple of storms.
Yeah, La Nina is fascinating. And Nolan, I've actually talked to you about this when I came up there a few months ago. La Nina typically means drier weather for Southern Colorado, but some of our wettest years, wettest winters have also been La Nina years, La Nina. So typically it's dry, but so again, just a few times though, we'll have some really wet years. Is it a guide? Yes. But can you say it's a La Nina year? We're definitely going to be dry. Obviously, no, we can't even say that. I wish there were more concrete things that we could point to in weather, but around Southern Colorado, there just really aren't.
I think El Nino and the Southern Oscillation helps give forecasters kind of a general outlook of what to expect for the winter. But then when we start talking about the shorter timescales where we're forecasting weather events and storm systems, those come out of the context of an El Nino or a La Nina year, and we just analyze that system and forecast based on what we're seeing, how the ingredients are coming together. How is the storm system developing? What is the moisture doing? What are the winds going to do? That type of thing. So really, it gives us a broad perspective of maybe what we can expect, but it will not drive every single weather event that you have during that winter. And these climate signals, El Nino, the Southern Oscillation, are really important with winter weather. But as you go into the summer months, the signal, the climate signal, is really not as strong. So it's hard to draw some conclusions about how the summer months are going to be.
Well, is a La Nina, is it actually predictable? Or do you look at the satellite image and say, oh, we're now in a La Nina?
Well, there are climate models that attempt to predict when we're going to El Nino or La Nina. But really, the overriding factor is measuring those sea surface temperatures. So that buoy data is really, really important in analyzing those temperatures for a period of time. And there's actually a specific part of the Pacific Ocean near the equator that they're measuring those sea surface temperatures before they say, yes, we're in a La Nina. Right now, we're still in La Nina. It's a fairly weak La Nina, though.
Mm-hmm. I kind of want to talk a little bit about sort of, obviously, you guys love what you do, studying the weather and so forth, the climate. I kind of want to talk for each of you, sort of bridging the gap between what you do and what the public sort of knows and should know. Matthew, obviously you're a weather broadcaster, so people want to know what the temperature is. And of course, Jennifer, you do the fire danger type of thing. So in sort of each of you, Nolan included, the capacity of what you do, how do you bridge the science to make it accessible to the public?
Well, I'll go ahead and start this one. Yeah, Colorado Springs, the city limits itself, spans 2,000 to almost 3,000 feet from one side of town to the other. And of course, that's going to have a huge impact on temperature. And actually, a lot of people ask me, when I forecast a high temperature for Colorado Springs, where is that high? Because it's going to be very different from the south side of Colorado Springs near the airport versus areas around Rockrimmon or Briargate, Mountain Shadows area. And so typically, I forecast for downtown areas. And I think people in town know to tailor whatever that forecasted temperature is to where they live just from their personal experience. When it comes to snowfall, thunderstorms, you know, you can forecast the weather, but a lot of times people will determine their forecast based on what's happening on top of their house or on top of their work or where they are. That's often going to make it very difficult to pinpoint exactly what the snow amounts that you're going to see will be versus, you know, even a few miles down the road. Anybody who's lived here for a year or two knows that, you know, after a snowstorm, you can drive just a few miles one way or another, and you're going to have a difference of several inches of snowfall just based on a couple miles. And so that's part of the reason that we give a range of snowfall potential. Then when it comes to storms, storms are convective in nature, meaning they just kind of pop up, and it's difficult to impossible to tell, give a long range of where those storms are exactly going to pop up. And so when we say there's a chance for a thunderstorm, doesn't mean you're going to see a thunderstorm. It means that there's a better chance that you're going to see a thunderstorm. And it's difficult because trying to portray that and get that out, because a lot of people, you know, they want to know what it's going to do on top of their house at that time. Whereas my forecast area covers, you know, not only El Paso County, but the rest of the southeastern plains. So compiling all this information, and then, like I said, not a whole lot of concrete details because of the wide range of terrain, topography, and what we're going to see in terms of different weather conditions.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer?
I would say that the National Weather Service has a very broad customer scope that we have to serve. And we have an aviation community. We're actually forecasting for aviation interests that fly into airports. We're trying to give them very detailed information so those pilots flying into those airports are safe. We have fire weather customers, so that could be firefighters, that could be emergency management, that could be people evacuating communities if there's a wildfire in the area. So we're communicating threats to them. Winter weather, we're trying to communicate to the public sector, but we're also maybe communicating to schools. Should they delay the start of school? Should they send kids home early? That type of thing. When it comes to convective weather, we're issuing warnings. We're telling people, we're trying to get people to take action based on our warnings because that thunderstorm poses a hazard to them. So we're trying to induce a desired response. Yet we really don't have a face-to-face presence with the public on a daily basis like Matthew would have through being on air and being a familiar face. But our meteorologists that work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we have a team of people on round the clock every day of the year. We work with people like Matthew and other people in the media to try and convey that information to the public. We also write numerous products, forecast discussions, where we get a little more technical. So people that have a little more knowledge of weather can read those and really get insight into what the forecasters are thinking for different types of weather events. So we do a lot of public outreach. We try to educate people about weather and hazardous weather. But we do rely quite a bit on the media to relay that information to the public.
Mm-hmm. And Nolan, what about you?
And I come at it just a little different as a climatologist, but weather and climate, both very public. It's so ingrained in the public because we all live and breathe the weather and climate together. And I love to connect people and their feelings about the weather and climate to what the data really show. I love showing historic time series of what the temperatures and precipitation have been over time at our best long-term weather stations, and then have people realize those ups and downs that they see on those graphs and how that may have affected their lives that year. 1999, the wettest year on record for parts of southeast Colorado. Just 3 years later, 2002, driest year on record for the very same area. And people can connect those points on a graph to what that meant for their lives. And that's one of the fun parts for me is connecting the science to the people through interpretation, graphical and on maps, to what our science is showing.
Nolan, as sort of the climatologist for Colorado, what are the multiple factors that sort of go into the changing climate and the what do you sort of see for Colorado in the future, and where are we now, and potentially nationally and worldwide as well? That's a really big question.
I was going to say, what a question that is. But I'm very accustomed to answering questions, or at least facing questions, not always answering them that well, about what the future looks like and what the past has taught us. And we've always thought that our past data that we've tracked, and again, for southeast Colorado, 130, almost 140 years of data in a few places, gives us a pretty good sense of how it varies from year to year, the wet periods, the dry periods, the hot episodes, the cold. But do we know for sure that that's how it's going to unfold into the future? Well, we don't. We know that computer models based on projections of ever-increasing greenhouse gases suggest that warming is a part of our future. And I'd very much like to be able to confidently tell you how that's going to play out. I don't know for sure how that will play out, but I know to a first approximation that the summer that you experienced in southeast Colorado this past year, 2011, would be very likely a normal summer just a few decades from now, if these computer models are anywhere as close to correct, and that we'll see more of those very warm and perhaps very dry summers. And it's a little bit disconcerting. But do I know that for a fact? No, I don't. I just know that that's the most likely scenario from the best of what we think we know about the climate and our ability to model it. But I do... I need to say right away that climate variability, the year-to-year changes, are what affect us the most. That 1999 to 2002 transition was huge, and its impact on society, on agriculture, on water planners was huge. And that's going to always be a part of our climate, these variations, because that's how the system works. It's not stable.
Jennifer, I see you nodding your head.
Well, I think, you know, my background is that I'm a meteorologist. I'm not a climate scientist. But the conclusion by many climate scientists that have examined this is that we are warming. The global temperature is warming. And I think, you know, like Nolan said, I just echo that. We really don't know how that's going to evolve. Just as we don't know if the winter storm coming in next week is going to dump a lot of snow or if it's going to be dry. You know, we have to examine these things as they evolve with time and keep analyzing the data, keep improving our computer models, keep improving the data that goes into the computer models, and do our best from there.
Mm-hmm. There's so many factors that go into it. So to make a blanket statement is really tough to do. The good thing is our ability to forecast long range is getting better. There's still a long way to go. But climatologically, with the data continuously changing, I think the biggest difference probably in some of the temperatures, I believe, that I read up on, especially around Colorado Springs, you know, we're seeing our overnight lows pretty much across the board a little bit warmer than they have been climatologically, for whatever reason, and that includes both summer and winter. Short term, how is that going to affect us? You know, there's so many factors that go into it at play. One of them, your El Nino oscillation. You know, how is that going to play into it? But then there's so many local effects too. So it's more of a wait and see type approach. In the meantime, you know, we're going to do our best to give you a good short-term forecast.
Mm. But I guess, you know, there's the joke that, you know, if it's 60 degrees in January or February, then, you know, you pick up your aerosol can and say, woohoo, you know, it's going to be 60. I want it to be 60 degrees in January or February, but it doesn't work that way.
No.
Okay.
Mm. Well, I keep in mind, if that trend stayed true, then we'd be well into the hundreds then eventually. and I don't know if that's the good trade-off that we would want. We always take the approach with global warming, which of course is a hot topic, pun intended, right now. I want to be careful that, you know, we keep the atmosphere as pristine as we can, you know, regardless of how much of an effect it has on local weather. It is certainly something that needs attention because there's so many different effects that we can see from that. But then the argument is, last month, extremely warm across the lower 48. We were the sixth warmest January on record. But again, you go up to Alaska, some areas in Alaska have their coldest month on record. And so you can't point to one specific month or week or day or even season to determine the effects of climate change across the globe.
Mm-hmm. Nolan, does that, as Matthew just said, the fact that we were warm, but Alaska saw some of their heaviest snow in coldest winter, do those types of things sort of indicate anything to you in a larger trend?
What's funny is the more you look at historic data, the harder it is to be impressed by anomalies, because you find we've had extremes. We just put together a talk for the Colorado Water Congress back at their January meeting about what did we think we know about the climate in the 1930s. And fascinating that there was already articles being written about climate change. We were already seeing this rapid warming that we thought, oh man, what is going on? We didn't understand why it was occurring. We didn't know the causes, but we were observing it happen. And then 75 years, 80 years later, we're still asking some of the same questions, but with many more tools and weapons to bring out to work against it. But it's just funny to see that we have had extremes in the past. We will have extremes in the future. Is it going to be more extreme? I don't know. It's already really extreme.
I think Jennifer. Last year, too, 2011 was notable for the number of severe weather events that were just absolutely devastating across the nation to large cities. Several billion-dollar disasters across the U.S., the Joplin, Missouri tornado, Birmingham, Alabama, many places like that. And people try and tie that to climate change, and I'm not the one to make that connection, but I will tell you that people are exposed to these high-impact, significant events. Anytime you have a tornado or a high-impact event in a very populated area, that's when people are exposed to, you know, this very hazardous weather. So I think regardless of the impact of climate change on the day-to-day weather and day-to-day weather events, as the population increases, as people move to coastal areas, they're going to be exposed to hurricanes. If they move to the center part of the country, they may be more prone to high-impact tornadoes that move through populated areas. So I think overall, just the increase in population really has some impact on the number of people that are exposed to high-impact hazardous weather events.
So it's the balancing number between people versus where these things already occur.
I think that's some of it. Mm-hmm. I can't draw that connection to mm-hmm. that being a function of the changing climate, but I know that, you know, people need to be aware of the weather in their area. Heed those warnings that we try and issue and let people know that you need to take action to protect yourselves. And, you have to learn as much as you can about the weather in your area and the threats that you may be exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems. You know, even when it comes to flooding, you know, you're going to have more flooding, as we said earlier, on pavement. If there's more pavement, meaning more developments, more people moving into an area that gets these strong thunderstorms. And yeah, that's one of the arguments, is that the development is creating a lot of more awareness to these events that actually were happening already. Whether or not that's the case, we don't know if there's just an increase in activity or there's more extremes. But it's definitely happening. Social media has often heightened the effect of how much we see, how many more tornadoes that we get reports of, which is good in a case that we can warn the public faster. Now, when we get reports of tornadoes, and oftentimes, almost instantaneously, viewers will send us pictures of a tornado that's happening, which is amazing. It's a sign of the times, certainly. Our Twitter update can go pretty far on doing some what we call nowcasting for some of these thunderstorms that happen. Whether there's actually more happening, that's a little difficult to tell, though.
I think that we're about to wrap up, so you know, I don't really have any. I think this is a great note to sort of finish on. But do any of you have anything else that you would like to add that maybe we didn't touch on?
I definitely want to say something.
Absolutely.
About.
Go ahead, Nolan.
About weather forecasting. I'm sort of the senior here of the group. I've been on duty at the Colorado Climate Center for this my 35th year, and if the public does not think that weather forecasts have improved over time, please think again. Forecasts are way better than they were 35 years ago. They're considerably better than they were 20 years ago. They're better than they were 5 years ago. Forecasting daily weather is really making huge strides and has continued to. Predicting what next year is going to be like, we've made some strides, but not nearly as much. So give the forecasters a lot of credit. There's been huge progress.
Excellent. Matthew or Jennifer?
Well, I just want to say we're about to come into, in my opinion, what's the most active time of the year, which is our spring, where we can have just these huge drastic changes from one day to the other. And I think anybody that's lived here knows that it can be pretty dangerous here in some cases. We learned that last year with fire danger. And so I just want the public to know that, you know, in connection and working with a little bit of the Climate Center, but it's certainly the National Weather Service here in Pueblo, coordinating, you know, these watches, warnings, advisories, and all different fire dangers that we do have. And this is a busy time of the year, whether it be fire danger or severe weather, and in some cases tornadoes or flooding, which we can all do at the same time. You know, we're doing our best and take those very seriously. I think sometimes people may get desensitized to a lot of the warnings that the National Weather Service puts out, but they put those out for a reason, and because we want to remind people to be cautious of these events when they do happen.
Thank you. Jennifer?
I would just say that living and working in Southern Colorado is always such a pleasure, and you know, I get to interface frequently with Nolan in the state climatologist's office, and as well as our TV meteorologist partners. And we really have some excellent folks here in Southern Colorado. You know, we're on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, trying to give you the best weather forecast that we can give you, as well as warnings and other type of information. So just really, really proud to be a part of the weather community in Southern Colorado.
Wonderful. Well, I think that does it for this roundtable. I thank you all for participating. Thank you, Nolan, for answering all the technical questions for how to get you involved with this, the roundtable. So thank you, everyone, Jennifer, Matthew, and Nolan.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.